From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The Justice Department just announced the redacted Mueller report will be publicly released Thursday morning. Neither grand jury testimony nor materials related to ongoing criminal investigations are expected to be included. Our weekly political roundup also looks at the growing field of Democrats running for president and the rising profile of the latest one to declare. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Nice to have you with us today. If you came by the Angel City Press booth Saturday morning at the LA Times Festival of Books, so nice to meet you, and nice crowd of KPCC listeners coming by. Great, as always, to meet you at that terrific event. Coming up, the impasse between the Writers Guild of America and the agents who represent them. We'll look at what effect the breakdown in negotiations could have on Hollywood productions. But first, the Justice Department, as you just heard, announced we'll have three more days to wait for the redacted Mueller report. Its release is scheduled for Thursday morning. That leads our political roundup this week. We're joined by Lisa Garcia Bedoya of UC Berkeley, where she's professor of political science and education. She directs Cal's Institute of Governmental Studies. And also with us from Stanford University, just across the bay at the Hoover Institution, research fellow Lonnie Chen. Lonnie worked as policy advisor for the Romney 2012 presidential campaign and Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential run. Great to have you both with us. First, let's talk about the impending release of the Mueller report. Lonnie, your thoughts on what you're hoping to learn from the redacted report.
Well, the biggest thing, Larry, I think that will be of interest to people, aside from the question of what got redacted and what we're to read from what's been redacted, is a fuller understanding of the degree to which there was interference, particularly cyber interference in the 2016 presidential election. I think that recall was the original mandate of the Mueller investigation, of the Mueller team, was to figure out exactly what kind of efforts were undertaken by foreign powers, in particular Russia, to interfere with our election. And I think former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein spoke to this issue when he was interviewed late last week. I forget what outlet was in, but he was essentially saying people should be on the lookout for elements of this report that elucidate exactly what the Russians did, how they tried to infiltrate our system of democracy, and the things that we can do to fight back against it. So I think those are very important points that shouldn't be lost in what will surely be a political back and forth about the information affecting and implicating the president and his campaign throughout the Mueller report.
All right. Lisa, what are you hoping to learn from the redacted report?
Well, I agree. I actually think knowing what was done and how we can protect against it is the most important thing that we should be focusing on, and sadly, something that hasn't been focused on. I think knowing more about what the evidence is, I think Mueller was very careful about not coming to conclusions, legal conclusions, appreciating that things aren't always black and white in the law. And it seems that Attorney General Barr did make some conclusions that perhaps folks aren't certain is supported by the evidence. So I think just more clarity and more of a sense of what we do know about what happened, and then potentially what we can do to avoid it in the future.
And then there's, of course, going to be the battle over the redacted content, grand jury testimony, materials that might be related to ongoing criminal prosecution or investigation, and material that might have intelligence sensitivity with sources and the like. Professor, do you support House committees going after that additional material?
I don't know whether it's a question of supporting it. I think the reality is this entire report has become so politicized that neither side, I think, will be happy unless the whole thing is released. And so I think so long as there are questions about what was redacted and why, and just the distrust on both sides, I think it makes sense for the intelligence committees to work the way that they're supposed to work in a bipartisan fashion, for them to be able to see the full report and to come up with a joint statement about what that information is. I think until there is a sense that people have seen it and been given the opportunity to judge for themselves, there are going to be folks on both sides that simply don't trust what they're being told based on the redacted information.
We're talking with Cal professor Lisa Garcia Bedoya, Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution. President Trump had this to say when musing about possibly bringing migrants entering the U.S. to sanctuary cities.
California certainly is always saying, oh, we want more people, and they want more people in their sanctuary cities. Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply. And let's see if they're so happy. They say we have open arms. They're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms.
There are, of course, legal questions about whether the federal government would be able to do this. But, Professor, I was wondering if this might actually be to the advantage of migrants coming into the United States to go to sanctuary locations where there is an infrastructure, where there is support, where there is a community of other individuals who've migrated. Could this actually, if it were implemented, be a benefit to those coming?
It actually could. The interesting thing we've been learning, at least here in the Bay Area, is that what has happened with the increases in costs of housing is that migrants have actually moved away from the places where those services are available. And so, ironically, I think you're exactly right that, in fact, going to the places where you have people who have set up infrastructure to help people integrate into the United States, actually the idea that that would be detrimental to the United States or to those localities is a fallacy. But I think the thing to remember is that even if people are bused to those places, in general, people don't migrate on their own. People migrate within networks. They migrate to reconnect and reunite with family members. And so even if they're put into those locations, folks are likely going to move to the places where they know people and where they have other kinds of connections. And so migration is not an individual act. It's a family act. And we have to appreciate that there are many parts of this country that are not full, but that, in fact, would benefit from migrants and their energy and their contributions to work and to society in the places where they choose to settle.
Lonnie, again, setting aside what the president's intent is, where he's making no bones about this, he thinks this would punish sanctuary communities. But do you think there's a case to be made for this actually benefiting the population involved?
Well, I think there's two elements here, Larry. First of all, the reality is, to the very thoughtful answer that the professor gave, I think that people aren't necessarily going to stay in one place. When you talk about migration patterns, people are going to go where they have networks, familial networks or other networks. And so it's probably not true to assume that simply dropping them off in a sanctuary city means that they stay there entirely. But there is more broadly, I think, the question that the president probably is trying to jumpstart in his own way, which is whether the so-called sanctuary city policies are the right policies for the various jurisdictions that have them. Obviously, this has been an issue that's been discussed in public policy for some time and for some number of years. It's been the source of some political tension as well. But I think where the president's trying to go with this is to ask a series of questions about whether sanctuary city policies in fact work and whether in fact we should be addressing them more thoroughly and more critically. Again, I think the challenge is in the politics of our time and the politics of how this president deals with issues. It can be a challenge to get to that bottom line point. But as a matter of policy, I think some of the questions he's raising are questions that deserve to be asked.
Well, but the sanctuary communities are typically ones where there are significant numbers of people who've come into the United States illegally, where there is a significant community of people that support each other, and you've got a typically Democratic majority in office who are supportive. I mean, it is to the benefit of Democrats to have more future Democratic voters, right? So the president talking about how this is a negative for those communities, is there any evidence it is?
Well, they may not be future voters if they come in as undocumented immigrants, and if unless there is some method that is created to create a pathway to legal status and eventually to citizenship, undocumented immigrants would not be part of a future voter base, legal and proper voter base. Well, but the question then becomes whether in fact the communities involved believe this is the right policy or not. Now, obviously, because they've elected the people they have, They probably think it's a good policy. But the point I'm trying to make is simply that it is a source of discussion, and I think one that needs to be had in some of these communities, to be sure.
All right. Professor, quick additional thought on this. You think it has any chance in the world of being implemented?
That I'm not sure the legality of it, but I just want to remind there is no such thing really as a sanctuary city. In fact, these cities cannot keep federal authorities from exercising and implementing immigration law within their borders. All a sanctuary city means is that a community has come together to say that we in fact welcome immigrants and that we see them as valuable members of our community, and those places may then potentially have more resources available to help people integrate and get back on their feet after migrating. But let's remember that it's a fallacy to say that there is sanctuary, because there really is not. And so the question is simply symbolic of how welcoming those places are.
But don't most of the sanctuary cities have policies where there's not cooperation with their jails, for example, to hold and detain people for ICE, things like that? So that would be more than symbolic benefit.
Well, it is a benefit, but the point is they can't keep the federal government from conducting raids within the confines of the city, as an example. They don't have the authority to do that. They can only keep their local law enforcement from cooperating with federal authorities.
We're talking with UC Berkeley Professor Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, Lonnie Chan of Stanford's Hoover Institution. Just a couple or a week or so after the mass shooting at two New Zealand mosques left 50 people dead, Democratic member of Congress from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, addressed the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, at their California banquet.
We have lived with the discomfort of being a second-class citizen. And frankly, I'm tired of it. And every single Muslim in this country should be tired of it. CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
The "some people did something" has been heavily criticized by Republicans and by President Trump as minimizing the effect of the 9/11 attacks. And just one correction, what the congresswoman said, CARE was not actually formed after the September 11th attacks. But this has now led to what the congresswoman says are death threats against her. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi says that security has been increased for the congresswoman after the tweets and criticism of the congresswoman about the comment. Lonnie, let me ask you your thoughts. First of all, you think this is fair to claim within the context of what she was saying that she was somehow minimizing the severity of the attacks?
I do think that some of what she has said, both in that speech as well as in her recent past, does create reason for people to be upset. That having been said, I don't think it's right for us to try and gin up, not for us, but for people who would do so, to try to gin up a violent response to her. I don't believe that has any place in civil discourse. But obviously, we can dispute the notion that one would minimize, for example, what happened on 9/11, or one would take issue with the United States support for Israel, which is something else that Representative Omar has done. So there are elements of her policy discussion. There are elements of what she says that I certainly disagree with. But the answer is not then to say that we ought to incite violence against her. That certainly should not be the response of any civil society or from any public leader.
The president had responded once the excerpt of the speech was made public with a tweet on Friday with a video of Omar's remarks, as well as an image of the Twin Towers, with a tweet saying, "We will never forget." Professor, your thoughts on how this has been portrayed and the reported threats against the congresswoman?
Well, I agree that there's no place for violence in our democracy. And in an ideal world, we would be able to have a real debate on the policy questions and what happened in terms of the Muslim community after 9/11, how those images have been used to foster and foment hate and other kinds of hate crimes, which we know have happened. I think it's important to remember that she's the only congressperson who uses a hijab. I think appreciating that the symbolism that she represents for some segments of American society leaves the door open for people to foster that violence. And it is absolutely wrong that she's facing death threats as a result of this. And so I would hope that we would dial this back, but it seems to be part of a strategy. I mean, let's be realistic. How many freshman congresspeople get this level of attention, regardless of what they're saying? She's not the first congressperson to misspeak or to say things that are perhaps insensitive during the course of their beginning of their political careers. And so the imagery that she represents, I think, is really powerful. And for that reason, we all need to be very careful about how those images get used in a negative way.
We just have another news. I'm just watching on television right now, and I'm sorry to interrupt. There's dramatic video of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris on fire. We'll keep you updated on it. There are bright flames that appear to be breaking through the roof. Now, the angle that they're at, I actually can't identify myself that it's Notre Dame, but the identification is that it is the cathedral. Now, I'm looking at a straight-on of the spire of the cathedral, but it's difficult to see whether the flames are actually coming up from the main part of the cathedral or not. I'm watching CNN right now where it says Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris on fire, and there's certainly a ball of flame coming through the roof of Notre Dame or the vicinity there. So we'll let you know just as soon as we have any additional information. AP now confirming Paris police say it is the cathedral that is burning in Paris. So obviously a very important historic structure. We'll have more information on that. Professor, I do want to go back to you, though, about the congresswoman, because just like AOC or Congresswoman Omar, I mean, they have decidedly carved out big profiles for themselves. So, is it unfair to go after them when they've really used social media and in the case of Congresswoman Omar, controversial comments to build their public profile?
Well, I guess the question is, what do you mean by going after them? Should we debate what she's saying from a policy standpoint, and should we have the ability to disagree with one another about how she's framing the things that she's talking about? Absolutely. Do we also need to appreciate that as one of only two Muslims in the Congress and someone that raises a certain kind of symbolism and that has had great power in the United States since 9/11 and that has led to many hate crimes against the Muslim community since 9/11, that then we have to be thoughtful about how that engagement happens? Absolutely, as well. So it's not that I'm saying that we can't say that we don't agree with her. That's very different than imposing her speech on images of the Twin Towers burning.
All right. Lonnie, is it unfair to go after her the way that some Republicans have or not?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's important, Larry, to point this out, that she is not an ordinary freshman congressman in terms of congresswoman, member of Congress, in terms of the way that she is approached speaking out on issues. Nor, by the way, is Ocasio-Cortez. Which is why I think it's silly when Nancy Pelosi says, and we may end up getting to this, when Nancy Pelosi says, well, this is just like five people running around. I mean, with all due respect, it's not. It's a very significant part of the progressive left right now. And I think that one has to recognize that when one steps out, they can expect to be engaged on issues. Now, as I said earlier, there's a difference between engaging on issues and just engaging on pure negative identity politics. But the point is that these people are not just random members of Congress hanging out as freshmen. They are a significant component of the progressive left. And for that reason, they do make news and people will talk about them, and they should.
All right. Let's continue as you teed this up very well, Lonnie. The 60 Minutes interview, Leslie Stahl with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And here's a portion of what the speaker had to say.
We just started. It was 3 months since we were in office.
But you're talking about 100 days. This president's been in office for 2 years plus.
And we've been here 3 months. Hey, may I introduce you to the idea of the power of the speaker is to set the agenda. We didn't have a speaker who would bring a gun bill to the floor. We didn't have a speaker who would bring a Dreamers issue to the floor. We do now. And that's a very big difference. The power of the speaker is awesome.
Nancy Pelosi defending the Democratic majority Congress. Now, President Trump then tweeted such a puff piece on Nancy Pelosi by 60 Minutes, yet her leadership has passed no meaningful legislation. All they do is investigate, as it turns out, crimes that they instigated and committed. The Mueller no collusion decision wasn't even discussed, and she was a disaster at the White House, I think, talking there about the meeting that blew up at the White House a few weeks ago. Professor Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, Nancy Pelosi obviously began her speakership this most recent time with questions about to what degree the newer members of Congress, the younger members, would support her. Your thoughts on how she's performed so far 3 months in?
Well, I think she's doing quite well in keeping a very raucous caucus together. We have to remember that the House did pass H.R. 1, which is a set of Democratic reform measures that one would hope would actually have bipartisan support in terms of running our democracy better and making our democracy more accountable to the people. I think in that interview, she laid out a policy agenda that should be bipartisan. The Dreamers, guns, infrastructure, these are all things that there is bipartisan support for these policies, both in terms of the folks in Congress and also in terms of the American people being very supportive of all three of those issues. The one thing she didn't talk about is the leader of the Senate and the fact that that's one of Mitch McConnell's unwillingness to bring these things to the floor is part of the challenge that she faces, because I think many of these bills would pass. So I think she's done a good job of laying out an agenda that her caucus can support and that ideally can have bipartisan support. But I think it's very difficult when you have a Senate leadership that has no interest in actually having any policies that pass that could be seen as Democratic wins.
We did bring the Green New Deal to a vote, but of course that was for different reasons. By the way, your raucous caucus, we have people think that should be a hashtag now. So that's popular. Lonnie Chen, what do you think about Nancy Pelosi's leadership? Obviously, she's got a challenge.
Yeah, well, I think under the circumstances, she's doing the best she can in the sense that she does have these divisions within her own caucus. She does have divisions that she is seeing that are indicative of divisions within the progressive movement. And I think to a certain degree, this is what presidential primaries are all about. Presidential primaries are there to resolve some of the differences that exist within parties, particularly differences that exist between a farther left wing of the farther left side of the Democratic Party and a more center left side of the Democratic Party. And we'll see how it works itself out. I think right now a lot of the media energy and a lot of the discussion we're seeing in the media seems to focus on the progressive left folks like Ocasio-Cortez and others. But it's not just them, by the way. If you look at the candidates who are running for president right now, the leading candidate of the Democratic Party is Bernie Sanders. And he's raised the most money. He is generating a lot of attention with his policy ideas, and he comes from that side of the party. So she's got a little bit of a task in terms of trying to keep the party moored to the center, because that's where it needs to be, I think, to win an election in November of 2020. But she's also, frankly, got to deal with the reality that a lot of the leading figures who are speaking out in Democratic politics today are on that far left side of the progressive spectrum. And so she needs to address those concerns and keep things together.
Speaking of the candidates, the Trump campaign announced that $30 million was raised for President Trump's reelection effort in the first 3 months of the year. So his campaign says they now have $40 million total with a goal of $1 billion for the 2020 race. As you mentioned, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, the top two Democratic fundraisers so far. And what the president's team says he has raised is more than the combined haul of both Sanders and Harris in the races. But who's getting a lot of attention in recent days, the latest declared candidate for president, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. He was speaking in launching his campaign yesterday, had this to say about the success of his city and what it means for his candidacy.
More people are moving into South Bend than we've seen in a generation. Thousands of new jobs have been added in our area, billions in investment. Now, there's a long way for us to go, but we have changed our trajectory and shown a path forward for communities like ours. And that's why I'm here today, to tell a different story than Make America Great Again. Because there's a myth being sold to industrial and rural communities. The myth that we can stop the clock and turn it back.
Pete Buttigieg, the latest declared candidate in the Democratic field, and a Monmouth University poll looking at Iowa showed Buttigieg with a very strong debut, coming in after Joe Biden with 27%, Bernie Sanders at 16, Buttigieg with 9, and then after him are Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren at 7% each, Beto O'Rourke at 6%, and others behind. Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, we've never had a mayor elected president of the United States, let alone a mayor coming from a mid-sized city like South Bend, Indiana. But clearly his speaking ability, his story has caught on with people, not to mention the fact he's just 37 years old. At the LA Times Festival of Books, I had multiple people come up. What do you think about Pete Buttigieg? There's a lot of buzz about him. And what do you think's his biggest challenge, you know, moving forward?
Well, I think his challenge is appealing to. We have to remember that this year, both Nevada and California have their primaries very early, and so very shortly after Iowa and New Hampshire. So I'm not surprised that he would have fairly good name recognition in Iowa. Some polling I've seen here in California suggests that he has very little here, given he doesn't have much of a reputation outside of the Midwest. So I think he's going to have to really broaden his appeal and make clear how he can translate his story to more diverse settings if he's going to do well in the early primaries and be able to stay in the field.
My thought is that we need to get to the debates to see how these candidates do head-to-head against each other. I think those are going to be really key. Lisa, what do you think?
No, I agree, definitely, especially because at this point it's such a large field that it really is about people knowing who folks are and what they stand for. I think Mayor Pete's gotten a lot of media attention for a lot of reasons, all of what you just said. And so the question is, does that translate into actual voter support? He's a very charismatic person. As you said, he's a good speaker. Other members of the field are as well. And so I think at this point it really is a bit of a popularity contest. And so it's difficult to judge whether, you know, people saying that they support Bernie is because they've heard of Bernie and they've never heard of, you know, Hickenlooper as an example. And so the debates are going to make a big difference in terms of introducing these folks to the electorate and helping people make judgments on policies and personalities rather than just name recognition.
Well, and I'm thinking, you know, Beto O'Rourke seemed to be the candidate of the month last month, and now Buttigieg is getting this attention. Lonnie Chen, you think this is just sort of we're going to go through this process where someone sort of comes to the fore and then recedes a bit?
Yeah, I mean, Larry, people forget this is how long presidential primaries are. I mean, if the leading Republicans in 2015, the same time frame in that cycle as we're in now, if the leading Republicans had gone all the way through, we'd be talking about a President Scott Walker or a President John Huntsman in 2011, or you know, you can think of all sorts of different examples. So the nature of primaries is that they do result in a lot of ebb and flow. And as people get to know candidates, they become more or less popular. I do think that Pete Buttigieg has something special about him. I think his ability to communicate, his ability to discuss ideas, his ability to connect in a really sincere way, at least as possible in a campaign setting, do make him an intriguing candidate. Now, will he be able to withstand the pressure that comes from a national primary campaign over these next few months? Will his fundraising continue? Does he have an infrastructure to support the level of interest in his campaign? Those are all questions that remain to be answered. And by the way, Larry, to your point, we don't actually know what it is that Mayor Pete wants to do. There's no policy associated with his campaign, whereas you look at someone like Elizabeth Warren, who's been sort of the leader in terms of the policy primary so far. So all those contrasts will become abundantly clear as we get closer to these debates and as we move into the more combative part of the campaign. It's easy now for all these candidates to be kumbaya, but believe me, they'll all be in very aggressive fight mode by the time we get to the fall, and it'll be interesting to see what results once they do.
Looking at House Ways and Means Committee trying to get President Trump's tax returns and the administration saying, no, that's not going to be released to you. But we have the Democratic candidates releasing their tax returns, Kamala Harris releasing hers for the past several years. And it's interesting that, pretty much the whole field has been able to extend their income beyond just what they're paid to be a senator or a member of Congress and the like. Lonnie, are they going to have to address their income somehow relative to the economic proposals they're making?
Yeah, it is going to be a unique challenge within the Democratic primary process. You know, a lot of people say that this is where the difference is between Democratic primary electorates and Republican primary electorates, that Republican primary electorates are much more inclined to give people who've been successful economically the benefit of the doubt. That certainly may not be the case. And by the way, may not be the case within the Democratic primary electorate. By the way, I was going to say that's why it's been so difficult, I think, for Bernie Sanders to release his tax returns. You know, he says he's going to put them out today. We'll see what he puts out and whether, in fact, he does. He's given some really bad answers, I think, to questions about how well, for example, his book has sold. And he said, well, if you write a best-selling book, you should do well, too. I'm not sure that response is going to go over particularly well with people in the Democratic primary electorate, but we'll see. The reality is that the difference here comes down to how Democratic primary voters view the issue versus how Republican primary voters might view the issue. And I do think it is going to be more of a challenge for some of these Democratic candidates to explain their economic success, as you say, in the context of various proposals they have.
All right. Lonnie Chen, thank you so much for being with us. Stanford's Hoover Institution, and Lisa Garcia Bedoya, professor at UC Berkeley, where she also directs the Institute of Governmental Studies at Cal. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Got a lot more news to cover for you coming up. The impasse between members of the Writers Guild of America and the agencies that represent them. Back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herty. Hedy just reported on Notre Dame Cathedral and the fire there. We'll keep you up to date on it as best we can. You can certainly see the flames around scaffolding that was apparently used for the renovation of the cathedral, and then flames appear to be breaking through the roof of the cathedral. We'll just keep you up to date as firefighters try to douse the flames and do whatever they can to save that landmark. Looking right now at the spire of the cathedral, and it appears to be engulfed in flames, the spire of Notre Dame. But there is a superstructure on it. There's the scaffolding on it. So it's difficult to see how deep the fire goes from the scaffolding into the spire itself. So we'll just have to keep a very close eye on that and see how much is the scaffolding and how much is the actual structure of Notre Dame Cathedral itself. Well, big news coming out of Hollywood on Friday. Thousands of writers have been told by the Writers Guild of America to fire their agents. This could have a big effect on production of new TV shows and films. The decree to fire one's agent comes in the midst of negotiations between the agencies and the Writers Guild of America. With us from Deadline, Hollywood senior editor Dominic Patton. Dominic, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Describe for us what happened and how this broke down.
Well, I mean, honestly, I think, Larry, that the WGA and the ATA, which is the Association of Talent Agents, I don't think that anyone really ever thought, even up until the last minutes when there were some proposals put on the table from the ATA, which represents the big giant agencies, specifically WME, CAA, UTA, and ICM Partners, they put a deal on the table about some packaging back-end money that they would be willing to hand over. It was dismissed pretty quickly by the WGA, and this thing headed towards what seemed to be an inevitable showdown. A few weeks ago, the writers voted overwhelmingly to pass a new code of conduct to supplement the 1976 agreement that existed between the WGA and the ATA. That code of conduct, one of the things it says is get rid of packaging. And the agencies have basically said, with a few tweaks around the side, no way, Jose, that's not going to happen. So they passed that. Then the deadline passed at the beginning of April. Then they had an additional, actually April 6th, then they had an additional few days of talks, a last-minute negotiation on Friday, basically ended with people walking out of the room going, we're done. And by Friday after late evening, already e-firings were happening. Some major, major writers like Damon Lindelof, who was one of the co-creators of Lost, and many other things. David Simon, the creator of The Writer, many others told their agents at CAA and otherwise, we're done. At least for now, we're done. Stand on day four.
Let's talk about packaging and what it is and why this has become a bigger issue for writers as the agencies have become significant players in putting projects together.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. And of course, because there's two sides to this. The agents say, not a problem. Well, sure, maybe we'll fix it up a little bit for you. They offered to give 1% of the back end back to the writers, for instance, additional to the Guild, which the Guild just said, well, that's not a serious proposal. I mean, that's nothing. Basically, packaging is this. An agency takes you as one of its writers and me as a director and someone else as a star and a few other people. We put together a package on a project. And then you go to a network or a studio with that package or a cabler or Netflix or whoever. And that's the deal. And in that process, the agents, in fact, the agency de facto becomes a producer on this. So they start receiving licensing money. They start receiving what can be millions of dollars. And they say, hey, we forgo our commission. So you don't have to give us your 10%. And hey, there's a risk factor because some shows succeed and some shows fail. And that's where they say, we're not really doing anything. The writers say, no way. You're making more money than we are. So you are doing something wrong because you're not representing your clients properly. In fact, you have a self-interest in this that requires, as a producer, if you want to keep costs down on anything, which everyone does, you're actually required to not represent your clients properly. And that's where they stand on this.
All right. So the impasse where we are, what's your sense, Dominic, on the of the effect on production? Is this going to stall out projects that were, you know, ready to move forward?
Yes and no. Right now, today, and there could be lawsuits coming any moment or any day. Right now, I kind of compare it to that period in about 1939 when Nazi Germany and the British and Britain were at war, but nothing really happened for about 6 months. The Nazis were still stuck in Europe trying to hold their control, and Britain was rearming. So there's a war, but no action. Right now, that's where we are. Most of the shows that are going to come forward later this year have already been staffed up, so those deals are already done. Most of the things that have been happening with big-time showrunners, they actually have their own overall deals with the likes of Netflix and many others, and Warner and what have you, so that actually doesn't affect them. So right now, we're kind of in a period where writers are firing their agents en masse, but there's nothing actually happening. But as you go forward, in the months to come, shows get canceled, shows get dropped, new shows have to happen, suddenly there's no agent representing a client. Some people say your lawyer can do it, which I have heard much on from a legal point of view in a positive sense. The Writers Guild say, the agents say, no, lawyer can't do that. It has to be an agent. That's what we deal with. We're an agency. We deal with a writer. So that's how it works. So right now, impact, minor. Going forward, big blast radius.
All right. We're talking with Dominic Patton, Deadline Hollywood senior editor and chief TV critic. I'd like to hear from you. If you're a member of the Writers Guild of America, if you are an agent, if you're someone who is going to be affected by this and not necessarily directly in either camp, Like to hear your thoughts about the impasse. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Or you can also comment on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. I just want to share that thousands of Parisians have gathered in the streets looking up at Notre Dame Cathedral, which is on fire right now. It appears that the fire might have begun where renovation work was being done with scaffolding around the cathedral. But according to an AP reporter who's on the scene, the roof at the back of the cathedral behind the nave is fully engulfed in flames. There's smoke filling the sky, ash as well. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo says firefighters are trying to contain a terrible fire at the city's Notre Dame Cathedral. There is a fireboat trying to get up close enough to put water on it from the river. Residents of Paris are urged to stay away from the security perimeter around Notre Dame. Firefighters are on the scene attempting to battle it. But right now, looking at it, the flames are just bright orange, and a portion of the roof appears to be fully engulfed at Notre Dame. We'll keep you updated just as we have additional details. Once again, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, to talk about the impasse as Hollywood writers have been told by their guild to fire their agencies in this dispute. Now, we had invited a representative of the WGA to join us. They're not able to do so. We also reached out to the Association of Talent Agents and the four major agencies that were involved in the negotiations. They declined our request for an interview, but the ATA sent us this statement from Executive Director Karen Stewart. The WGA leadership today declared a pathway for compromise doesn't exist. Agencies have been committed to reaching an agreement with the WGA, but despite our best efforts, today's outcome was driven by the Guild's predetermined course for chaos. The WGA is mandating a code of conduct that will hurt all artists, delivering an especially painful blow to mid-level and emerging writers while dictating how agencies of all sizes should function. That's a partial statement from the Association of Talent Agencies. We'll continue our conversation. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. We'll keep you updated on the fire burning at Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Very dramatic scene. Huge crowds of Parisians have come out onto the streets to look up at the fire where official trying to keep a security perimeter. But at this point, it does not appear they're making a lot of headway on battling those flames where renovation had been going on. On the facade there on the outside of Notre Dame. With us, talk about the impasse between members of the Writers Guild of America and the largest of the talent agencies, Dominic Patton of Deadline Hollywood. Also with us, the owner and CEO of Claire Best and Associates, a boutique talent agency in Hollywood, Claire Best. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Best.
Thank you, Larry.
So you were willing to sign on to this deal. Explain for us why an agency like yours, that would make sense, maybe why some of the other larger agencies would not want to do that.
Yes. So we are a licensed talent agent in California, and it was pretty easy for us to sign the code of conduct because it pretty much followed what we were doing anyway as part of the labor code for California. So it really, for us and other boutique agencies, I think it wasn't really an issue. Although we do help package, we don't take fees. And so we have a different business model than the agencies in the larger agencies in the ATA. That said, I want to be upfront, which is we really respect our colleagues in the ATA and we also really respect the WGA, so I think us and many boutique agencies kind of find ourselves neutrally in the middle and still carrying on able to do what we're doing, but we're not against one side or the other. We do believe the model has to change, but our signing is definitely not a sign of any of us going up against the ATA. It's just it's easy for us. Mm-hmm. That's what we were doing anyway.
Well, and you said that your view was that the packaging fees violate California's labor law. Is that because of the conflict of interest potential or other reasons?
Yes. Well, I mean, my understanding is that under the California labor law, and I'm not a lawyer and I haven't studied in depth, but as an agent, I've read it, you're supposed to be pretty upfront about what commissions you take, and you're supposed to put your client's interests above those of your own and have your income tied as a percentage of your client's interests. So, yes, I think that one of the issues is that, you know, quite a few showrunners and so forth maybe haven't been aware of the agency packaging fees that are going with the shows. I mean, they're not kind of out there. They are now as a result of this negotiation that's gone south. But before, you know, it was pretty opaque. And I think that is a problem. I think that's an issue. And I also want to say that, you know, the whole model of the industry has changed. So it's not just the big four agencies, but also the whole nature of, you know, television and film and how it gets ordered these days. It used to be that you would order 22 episodes of a show, and so a writer would be hired for 22 episodes. But now, very often, those shows are, you know, 8 to 12 episode orders. And so the writer's hired for 8 to 12 episodes and therefore potentially getting less money across the course of the year. But the actual production costs of those 8 to 12 episodes might be much, much higher. You know, Game of Thrones is a very obvious example where the per episode fee just from the production values is much, much higher. So if the agencies are negotiating packaging fees based on the overall budget, then that's, you know, that can be a substantial number, much bigger than used to be.
And, but the writers' compensation wouldn't go up. So is it fair to say in this glut of series production that's going on right now, there are more jobs for writers, but if you get onto a series, there are fewer episodes, so an individual writer's income will be less?
Very potentially, yes.
Okay. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dominic, do you know if the Writers Guild has addressed this issue of packaging fees relative to California labor law?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of gray areas about this. You know, I think that there's a lot of discussion to just go through some of the points that our fellow guest had. You know, this has been around since 1976 is when this started. Nobody really had many problems with it then because of the way the industry was. And as was pointed out, the industry has greatly changed. I do disagree that especially showrunners, who are usually creators or co-creators of shows and hence the head writers in most cases, and literally as the name suggests, run the show, I disagree that they're unaware of this. This has been a discussion within the industry certainly for the past 4 or 5 years where people have become more and more aware of it. I think that the numbers have become a little harder for some to digest because of the changes we've seen. So where it was, you'd get it on a 22-episode show. Now it's 6, maybe it's 13, this and that. And combined to that, and this is a very important part of it that sometimes gets overlooked, often when you are a writer or someone who's hired for such a show, you are actually locked in for a period of time. So it's not just that you're getting less episodes, you're getting less chances to make money because you're locked into a particular episodes of a particular series, which limits your mobility and your ability to go find other work. As opposed to the laws here in California, again, this has been around for decades. So if California had a problem with it, I don't know why no one's ever been throwing people into court seriously until now. I think that this has been one of those many things in the industry where people all kind of looked at it through rose-colored glasses if it worked out for them and looked at it through piercing microscopes if it didn't work out for them. Now we're reaching a slightly different situation, and that's where you're going to have to find everyone is going to have to make some degree of change to account for the realities.
Dominic, the ATA in the statement that I excerpted talked about this hurting those sort of, you know, mid-level writers, emerging writers. What can you flesh that out a little bit? Why would the writers being told to fire their agents, why would that particularly hurt those folks?
Well, two things. As we talked about showrunners earlier, and showrunners, of course, have a multifunction. They're producers, they're writers, maybe even directors as well, depending on the particular show. They also have, many of them, big overall deals. Shonda Rhimes, Ryan Murphy, many others have signed multi-million dollar deals in the past few years with the likes of Netflix and others. Ava DuVernay has a big deal with, for instance, with Warner. So you're looking at that. So they have a multiple of functions. So put it this way, none of them are going to be worried about paying their Visa card next month. However, people who are low level to maybe mid level, I don't mean that as any disrespect at all, they don't have those opportunities or that soft web to fall back on. They go from series to series like many of us go from paycheck to paycheck, and that's what keeps the lights on for them. Those people don't have the, let's say, pardon the pun, agency to control their fate in the far as more established and more well-compensated showrunners and writers do. And so they are going to take a hit on this down the line. Of course, you could also have something where, say, Larry, you're a showrunner of a particular show, and you're like, you know what, Dominic hasn't written a lot, but I liked what he did, so I'm just going to hire Dominic directly. That could become a little difficult in some of the mechanics of it, but that is possible. But the ATA and the WGA are both looking at the mid to lower level writers and saying, this is where the impact of packaging truly lands.
Right.
And this is what we're fighting over.
Hey, thank you so much, as always, Dominic Patton, Deadline Hollywood senior editor, Claire Best, owner CEO of Claire Best & Associates, a Hollywood-based boutique talent agency, which has reached agreement with the WGA. They're not part of the Association of Talent Agencies. Tear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Momentarily, you'll hear the latest on that large fire burning at Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Also, we'll take a look at Tiger Woods' remarkable achievement yesterday. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour on 89.3, we'll talk about a bill that would ban dissections of animals in high school biology classes. This is a bill that's come up from time to time. We'll debate it coming up later this hour. But first, even if you're not a golf fan, what an accomplishment yesterday. Tiger Woods winning his fifth Masters, his 15th major, his 81st PGA Tour event, but winning it at the age of 43 after years of physical ailments, setbacks, admitted struggles with alcohol and other substances, breakup of his marriage. Tiger Woods with a remarkable comeback win yesterday after years of not having won a major. The question is, where does this feat put him historically versus others who later in their professional sports life accomplished something great? NBR sports correspondent Tom Goldman joining us. Tom, thanks so much. Where do you put this compared to late career feats of other athletes?
Hi, Larry. Good to be with you. And, you know, I'm going to kind of do like Tiger, who declined to say this was the absolute greatest. He said it's right up there. So I'll take a page from Tiger yesterday and say it's right up there, certainly. And it may be even greater. I mean, considering the gap, you know, it's the longest gap between Masters champions in the history of the tournament, 14 years, 2005 to 2019. And you know, just the combination of things that he dealt with that you just detailed there. You know, there were other, you know, moments, comeback moments. Sticking with the game of golf, we had the legendary golfer Ben Hogan. He nearly died in a car crash in 1949, but came back to win six major titles, if my hasty math was correct. And but he won, you know, as recently as 1950 after his 1949 car crash. You had Formula One one driver, Alex Zanardi, who lost both legs after a horrible crash in 2001, and then he came back and he drove a specially adapted car in which he won a race. He picked up hand cycling and competed in the New York Marathon, competed in the Paralympics, and one other, of course, Muhammad Ali, who missed three and a half of his prime years in his mid to late 20s when, because of his opposition to the Vietnam War and refusal to be inducted into the military, he was pretty much exiled from boxing and came back and still had a brilliant career.
Tom Goldman, NPR sports correspondent. I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. Where do you put Woods' feat of yesterday in other historic comebacks, late career achievements? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. And President Trump has just announced he intends to award the highest civilian honor that a president can bestow, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, to Tiger Woods. President Trump just announcing that Tiger Woods will be receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award that our nation bestows. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Also with us, Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay. Jason, thank you for being with us. Where do you put this historically?
I put it pretty close to the top. I mean, I think that, you know, there have been some great comebacks in the past, you know, from personal demons and troubles and setbacks and injuries and so on. But when you consider the scale of what Tiger Woods was as an athlete, how transformative he was in a sport which had been so long exclusionary, and you consider what the last decade has been like, both in terms of the personal humiliation of what was happening in his private life, and then just really a series of severe injuries to the point where it's the guy just did not resemble himself. You know, when you just consider the attention that this guy garnered early in his career, the doubt that surrounded him, again, that humiliation, it's got to be right up there at the top. And to do it, and to do it so well, there was no sort of like asterisk about this. He beat the best competition in the world, playing at its very best. He beat a lot of broad-shouldered millennials who had his poster on the wall as kids. I mean, Tiger Woods really, you know, defined golf for a great many of the people who are out there in the field yesterday at Augusta. So I put it right up there at the top.
Well, and 22 years after, to put this in a little bit of perspective, his first Masters win, which I think it's hard for some of us, you know, in my age group to think about how long he's been on the scene in golf and all the physical ailments that he's gone through in that period of time, and back surgery. I mean, it's just it's remarkable. I'm trying to think of something that would be at all comparable to this. I seem to recall George Blanda, the quarterback at 52, leading a playoff victory at that age. Is, you know, we're talking certainly a very, you know, small number of events, Jason, that would fit this accomplishment.
Yes, it would be like me going back to my high school baseball team and pitching a no-hitter. I really do think that we're really searching if we're going to try to find something that's up there, just again, in terms of the scale of it. And Woods, you know, as you say, a lot of this stuff feels like ancient history. He's only 43 years old. You know, this is a person who still theoretically at least has some more golf, competitive golf left in him. But he was so preternaturally good and dominant and collected those championships at such a rate early in his career that we just thought, at this point, he would have ridden off to the sunset at this point with 30 or more majors to his credit. It was that sort of yawning gap in that middle, 11 years without a major championship, questioning everything. And this was not just, you know, public speculation. Woods was very candid about the fact that he saw the end coming. This is a great surprise to everybody, but especially to Tiger Woods.
I got up, put it on when I got up yesterday because I knew how close he was. And I just thought, well, let's see how he does. And I wonder, Tom, if, you know, part of this is at this point in his career, perhaps there's less pressure. He obviously had to deal with some of the dicey weather conditions yesterday and the fact the Masters is such a huge event. But, you know, not having the pressure that he had earlier where he went into every tournament, people expecting him to win.
I don't know, Larry. I think Tiger Woods puts an amazing amount of pressure on himself, and you know, all through his comeback year last year when he was building to this, we were all kind of hyperventilating about what he was doing, but he was very laser focused, and I think he knew that if his back held up, this was going to be an eventuality. Now, whether that made him put more pressure on himself or not, I'm not sure, but I think he was. I don't think he was doing this with this idea that, oh, you know, I've won 14 and I'm good and whatever. I think it was very important to him.
All right. Go ahead.
Larry, I'd like to add one thing. You know, Jason talked about going back to his high school and doing well. But we should add, you know, if you did that after being publicly shamed and humiliated, you know, I think as he's done, which I assume you weren't, Jason, but I think as the injuries have taken over in recent years, we forgot the mental blow to him from the scandal at first. And anyone who plays golf knows that golf is such a mental game. And what Tiger, it really rocked him, and he lost that sense of invincibility, I think, because he was rocked so hard psychologically. So I think the combination of the injuries that have been so well documented in recent years, and then, you know, not forgetting that when the scandal first broke, it reduced him to something that he was very unfamiliar with.
We're talking with NPR sports columnist Tom Goldman, Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay, about yesterday's remarkable achievement by Tiger Woods. With all the years since he'd won his last major, coming back, winning the Masters yesterday, a remarkable four-day run that he had in the rounds of that tournament, and at age 43, winning the Masters. You want to comment on historically where that stands? We're at 866-893-KPCC. We have just received word the iconic spire of Notre Dame Cathedral has collapsed, and fire continues to burn apparently unimpeded within Notre Dame Cathedral. We can't tell whether it began in the scaffolding for construction where they were doing renovation and restoration on the cathedral. It's my understanding that tourists were still allowed to go in even as the work was ongoing. But fire began. It appeared to be close to where the scaffolding was, then took over the spire and the roof. It's fully involved in flames. And I've not seen in any of the video of the cathedral any water being applied anywhere. Now, there have been reports that firefighters have had a difficult time getting ladders. Their ladders aren't tall enough there, but I haven't seen any sort of aerial effort. We're not seeing any water going up onto Notre Dame from the angle where TV news cameras are focused. There are thousands of Parisians in the street looking up, very downcast, looks of concern on their faces. And obviously, this is a huge loss. Whatever damage has been done to this point, and now we're starting to see some water going on the roof from a crane with a high-powered hose that's getting some water on. This is the first I've seen in the extended period since the fire broke out with water actually going on it. So I guess they call that a water cannon that's firing from an extended ladder there. Again, it's a massive fire that's engulfed the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral in the heart of Paris. Thick plumes of smoke that are making their way into the sky. And it's not just that it's an architectural masterpiece, but of course there are works of art that are included within the cathedral. It is one of the world's most famous tourist destinations as well. And we have no reports of injuries or any fatalities, but the fire spread very quickly and is very intense at Notre Dame. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR's Paris correspondent, joins us now. Eleanor, what have you been able to learn about this terrible fire? Eleanor, are you there? Okay, we're going to try and get her back. She's just telling our producer that it's very chaotic in the center of Paris right now near the cathedral. Eleanor, who's reporting you here on NPR, she's trying to get close to bring her eyewitness account of the fire at Notre Dame. We just lost our connection with her. And as you can understand, in the chaos, in the heavy use of wireless communication in the heart of Paris, it's going to be very difficult. We are going to do our best to get back connected with Eleanor. Eleanor, I think we got you now. Describe for us what's going on in Paris, please.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm trying to get to Notre Dame, and already, I mean, there's huge billowing smoke over the skies of Paris. I was near the Eiffel Tower, and I'm trying to make my way. It's not that far, but the city is just pandemonium. They've cut the trains. The metro is not going past there anymore, and the traffic is crazy. People are crying on the radio. People are in a state of shock. I mean, this is not just a symbol of Paris. It's a symbol of France, of its history. It doesn't matter what religion you are. Notre Dame de Paris is France. The spire has collapsed. President Macron had a very important speech tonight. He's canceled it all. He's on his way. This is just tragic. People are just beside themselves. And apparently they're not able to put this fire out, and people are just watching it burn. And I'm almost there. I can see the smoke, and I'm about to get out of the taxi and make my way the rest of the way on foot. This is a real, I mean, the architecture, the priceless art inside, the list goes on. This is a real symbol of France.
It's just heartbreaking to see. And for the first time on any of the televised images, I'm seeing water from a water cannon going on to the heavily damaged roof. But before that, I hadn't seen from the angles I was looking at any water. Have you heard any reports about firefighters having a difficult time getting the hoses up high enough to fight this?
I'm sure they did. I just heard that they have mobilized just masses of firemen. I can't tell you how many firefighters are there, but way, you know, they've brought everyone in. It must be very hard to get to, you know, someone else commented that where are the firemen, but they're there. I guess, you know, you just can't go in blasting hoses inside Notre Dame. It must be very difficult is all I can say. And of course they're trying to put this out, and this is tragic. Yeah.
It is just so sad. Eleanor, also, can you tell us anything about the renovation or restoration? Do you know any specifics on what they were doing?
Well, I do, because I was watching a television news show the other night, and there's these lines of statues, beautiful bronze statues on the roof that were actually added, I think, in the late 17th or 18th century, and they're taking them down for cleaning, and they had to take the heads off to lower them down because they had to put the hooks in the body because there's like 300 pounds or more, 1,000 pounds each or something. And so they were talking about the meticulous work of taking them off and how they're going to restore them. So it was a big work, you know, and that's what they were doing, I guess, when the fire broke out. It's somewhere in these renovation works. And, you know, just a few years ago, 2013, it was the 850th anniversary of the cathedral, and there was just huge celebrations, and it got new bells, and all the bells had names, and, you know, there's so much, this is a personal, like, friend for Parisians, and so people came out to hear the new bells ring for the first time, so people follow the life of this cathedral. You know, of course, there's Notre Dame de Paris, Victor Hugo's novel, and then there's the Disney movies and cartoons, and it's just known the world over, and it's the most visited monument in France, 20 million visitors a year, and someone I just heard on the radio said, and the most visited in the world.
Wow. extraordinary. Again, we're looking right now at a water cannon attempting to make progress on the flames that have come through the roof. But Eleanor, the flames, I don't see them diminishing even with that water cannon. The intensity must be so great that they're just not making progress, at least at the angle that I'm watching the video. You mentioned the spire, that iconic spire, has collapsed after flames went up. There was scaffolding, it looked like, was around that. Is that accurate? And the scaffolding burned, and then the spire itself?
I believe so. But, you know, when I heard that spire collapsed, and it's strange that you're telling me what's happening because you're watching it on TV and I'm in a cab, but I'm just getting out. I mean, I just somehow felt a shiver, like almost when the towers collapsed. And not at all the same thing, but there's something just heartbreaking when that spire collapsed.
The symbolism is so powerful, as you say.
Symbolism is powerful. So I'm getting out of the taxi now. It's just, it's just as crazy in the streets. Everyone is heading that way, and you can see the smoke just over the city. It's just so
Wow. It's remarkable. I know you may be getting out of breath from a quick pace here, so feel free to go whenever you need to go, Eleanor. I just appreciate your being with us and talking about it. But can you tell us, are there police, can you see them moving people back at all, or are people able to get reasonably close?
Gosh, no, I think they're moving people back. No, because, see, I'm now they're blocking off streets. There's just police everywhere, and they're blocking off streets. So, it's chaotic.
Okay, I'm going to let you go so you can focus on navigating where you need to be. Thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR's correspondent in Paris. And she's just arriving there on the scene. You'll, of course, hear her reporting this afternoon on All Things Considered. Hetty is also going to be reporting throughout the course of the day. And I'm going to keep you abreast with what I'm able to glean from our video feeds of Notre Dame Cathedral, where the roof fully engulfed in flames. And they're attempting to get a handle on it. The iconic spire collapsing after flames went the entire length of the spire. The damage appears to be quite significant. President Macron canceling his planned speech tonight, in which he was going to address unrest and criticism of his government. He is apparently on his way to arrive at the scene, and we'll keep you updated on the damage as this massive fire unfolds. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Well, today, income tax returns are due April 15th. We're going to take a look at how the new tax laws affected Californians, who's been the winners, who's been the losers under the new tax system that's in play for the 2018 tax year. But first, I do want to give you an opportunity, if you want to weigh in on the massive fire at Notre Dame, you want to talk about the cathedral, what it means to you when you visit it, if you've been there, your favorite aspects of it, favorite thoughts of Notre Dame, as the massive fire burning there. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We'll also create a page on the Air Talk page where you can comment on that. Joining us to talk about Tax Return Day is Jason Oh, UCLA Professor of Law and Specialist on Tax Policy. Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Larry, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So one of the things we heard a lot is that there were many Californians caught by surprise because the deductions throughout the tax year might have been smaller than what they had expected would be based on prior years and ended up owing at the end of the year. Do we know how widespread that was?
It's pretty widespread in California. There are two things really going on that really affected Californians. One is there were changes made to the withholding tables by the IRS. The The idea is, you know, when you receive your paycheck from your employer, your employer goes ahead and takes a portion of your pay and kind of sends it directly to the government. And we call that wage withholding. And in the aftermath of the Trump tax plan, the wage withholding rates were changed in a way that affected not just Californians, but Americans everywhere. And the withholding was a little bit more generous, which meant that employers were taking a little less out of your paycheck each year. But what that meant is, you know, April 15th is today. It's tax day. People are rushing to file their taxes. And what they're finding is because they were getting a little bit more with each paycheck, their refunds are smaller now.
We actually got an email that went out to all of Southern California Public Radio telling us about, you know, be careful to check your deductions. You may not have enough deducted under the new tax law. We urge you to take a look at that. And I'm wondering how widespread that was, that employers, you know, thought of this and were considerate enough of their employees to do that.
You know, it's
Did they at UCLA?
When people first start work, there's a form called the Form W-4, where you kind of report what your basic tax characteristics are as a household, right? And most people do that once when they on-ramp on a job and then never look at it again, right? Maybe look at it again if they get married or have a child. I know that a lot of employers did reach out to their employees to say, hey, this is something you need to be mindful of. I don't know how many employees took them up, right?
Yeah.
It's so easy to kind of ignore your taxes until April 15th rolls around.
Out of sight, out of mind. Jason, what about total tax for the year? Because with the state and local tax deduction cap that was part of this tax bill that was passed by Congress and signed by President Trump, the idea was this was disproportionately going to hit high tax states like California. Do we have a sense of who were the losers under that, but who gained enough in overall tax cuts that they made up for it elsewhere?
So the story really changes depending on what part of the income distribution you're focused on. So if you look at kind of low-income Californians weren't itemizing their deductions before the law change. And so the SALT deduction really didn't affect the limitation placed on state and local taxes didn't really affect them that much. And some of the other changes that the tax plan put in place resulted in a small benefit for a lot of low-income Americans and low-income Californians. So there was a small increase in the child tax credit. There were a couple other provisions that resulted in, I think on average, let's say, a 2% increase in after-tax income, 1% to 2% increase in after-tax income. If you look at higher income Californians, that's when the state and local tax deduction limitation really starts to take a bite, right? And one of the things in California, as I'm sure you know, Larry, is that, you know, it's not just our income tax, it's also our property taxes, right? So one of the things about this $10,000 limitation on state and local tax deductions is that it's a limitation in the aggregate on your property taxes plus your income taxes. And it turns out you don't have to be that far up the income distribution if you own property, if you own your home in California, to be hit by this state and local tax deduction limitation. And so, you know, median home prices in LA are much, much higher than, you know, median home prices in much of the rest of America. And a lot of Californians are feeling the hit of this limitation on the deduction,
particularly if they're newer purchasers of their home, right? Because they wouldn't have the Prop 13 protection keeping their property taxes lower.
Exactly.
Yeah. Also, for those who are independent contractors, how are they affected? Because so many Californians aren't traditional employees, but are de facto self-employed.
Yeah, there were actually a couple of rules in the most recent tax changes that benefit independent contractors quite a bit. And in fact, there's some talk of people intentionally declassifying themselves as employees and being rehired as independent contractors because of the different tax treatment under the tax laws. Of course, that means giving up some of the other benefits like health insurance that you would get if you were an employee rather than an independent contractor. But there are some rules in the most recent tax law changes that benefit independent contractors. I'll just mention one, which is really important, which is there's new pass-through deduction, which allows people who are non-employees to take a 20% deduction for their income, subject to a lot of very complicated limitations. So they're paying taxes at, you know, a rate that's 20% lower than they otherwise would.
All right. So that's a big advantage there. Professor, thank you so much. Appreciate on this tax day you're talking us through some of the changes and who benefited and who ended up paying more as a result of the new tax law. Thanks so much.
Oh, no, not at all, Larry.
Appreciate it. UCLA law professor and tax policy specialist Jason Oh joining us. He's the faculty coordinator of the UCLA Colloquium on Tax Policy and Public Finance. I asked listeners to share their thoughts about Notre Dame, their visits there, the power of the cathedral. In case you just tuned in, Notre Dame, the roof of the cathedral is engulfed in flames. The iconic spire completely burned and collapsed. Firefighters are trying to get a handle on the flames, but they're still burning brightly. It is a massive fire right in the heart of Paris at this iconic, most visited tourist attraction in the city. Letty in Riverside, share with us your thoughts about Notre Dame.
Well, I remember visiting Notre Dame in 2012 on Palm Sunday with my mom and my sister, and this was such a big trip for us because, you know, being raised Catholic and to be at that church, especially on Palm Sunday, was extremely, just an extremely, you know, honored opportunity to just be there and to see it on fire. It just kills me. This is the last trip I took with my mom and my sister before my sister was diagnosed with leukemia the following year. And, you know, she did pass away from that disease. And to see it on fire and to look back on the pictures we have and the memories of that day and just seeing the joy on my mom's face, you know, I'm just so sad to see that it's on fire. And what a loss for Paris. What a loss for the world.
Oh, yeah. It's just hard to imagine a remarkable structure like this. Thank you, Letty, for sharing your memories, your experiences. We're sorry about your sister and loss, but I mean, what wonderful memories that you had making that trip with your family, with your mother and with your sister to Notre Dame. If you'd like to talk about Notre Dame Cathedral, probably the best way is to tweet at AirTalk, and we're going to share your thoughts about Notre Dame from your tweets. You can also post on our AirTalk Facebook page. Let us know if you have special memories, thoughts about Notre Dame as this massive fire continues to burn. Oh, it's huge at this point, running across the entire length of the roof. With more details, an update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. We'll continue to bring you coverage of the massive fire burning at Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Hedy will be bringing you updates, and of course, NPR. We earlier heard from NPR's Eleanor Beardsley as she was taking a cab to get to the scene and trying to get close enough to report. The deputy mayor of Paris saying colossal damage suffered in the fire, and French President Emmanuel Macron saying the fire consuming Notre Dame is taking part of all of France's people with it. And he is apparently making his way to the scene, which is presumably difficult for him as it is for everybody else because of the throngs of people in the street, thousands of Parisians observing this massive fire. Coming up later today on KPCC, journalist and biographer Robert Caro, who spent decades on his biographies of Lyndon Johnson and New York power broker Robert Moses, tells us how he does his work and why. The nature of political power in his writings, The Focus. That's Fresh Air coming up at noon right here on KPCC. Also, want to alert you that The Frame coming up at 3:30 and 7 o'clock today will have in-depth coverage of the impasse between the Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agencies. Writers who are guild members have been told to fire their agents as a result of that impasse on the packaging fees and what writers say is the conflict of interest in agents putting together those packages with multiple parties involved. But we turn our attention now to a California bill that would ban animal dissection in high school biology classrooms in California. The act argues that animal dissection is costly, exposes participants to carcinogenic chemicals, and is harmful to animals and the environment. With us is Dr. John Pippin, Director of Academic Affairs at Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a co-sponsor of the bill. Dr. Pippin, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. It's great to have an opportunity to address this.
Well, and first of all, what are the alternatives to animal dissection that you think would equally educate students on animal biology and anatomy?
Well, I wouldn't say equally. I would say would educate superiorly compared to using dead animals for this purpose. There are purpose-designed computer-based programs ranging from professional dissections with accompanying commentary and educational information that can be observed, which of course is superior than to students kind of fumbling their way through dissection of animals. There are virtual reality programs that are actually remarkable that can present any species from earthworms all the way up to humans and allow students to interact with these using virtual digital dissection tools and perform their dissections online, again with accompanying educational information, none of this of which is available when you're dissecting animals.
So I just remember from my high school experience dissecting a fetal pig, there is the hands-on aspect of that you get. And how would you get that same sort of hands-on experience? Would there be any other way?
Well, if by hands-on experience you mean actually participating in the dissection, the software that I described to you allows that. It allows the students to actually use digital tools to perform the dissection. If you're talking about sticking your hands in cancer-causing chemicals and fumbling with trying to undo the bowel and find the gallbladder and so on, I would say please quote for me any peer-reviewed study that shows that has intrinsic value.
Okay, so you think the two-dimensional, you don't need the three-dimensional hands-on. You think the two-dimensional digital experience is better?
No, they are three-dimensional.
Oh, they are.
Three-dimensional tools.
Okay.
Presented in a digital format that are interactive. And by the way, it can be programmed by the science teacher to display specific aspects that teacher may want to include in the education.
Dr. John Pippin with us, a Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Also with us is Sherry Onne, who's president of the National Association of Biology Teachers. She opposes this bill. Thank you so much, Ms. Onne, for being with us. Why do you think that these other alternatives are inferior to dissecting an animal?
Thank you for the opportunity to speak as well. I can tell you that NABT's position is that each teacher is the expert in the classroom and needs to be able to decide for him or herself what makes sense for her classroom or community. That we do support California's current policy of allowing students to opt out. I do want to mention that there's a paper peer-reviewed by the American Physiological Society where they put students at three different stations for 45 minutes, and one group of students had a plastic model, another group had an actual heart, and the third group a virtual experience. They tested the exam scores, and the students with the plastic model actually tested higher, followed by the students with the actual heart, and then last was the virtual experience. But what became interesting beyond that is then they tested also student attitudes towards science, which excited them, made them think they could become scientists, what felt like an authentic experience. And in that case, the actual heart scored highest, followed by the plastic model, and finally the virtual.
All right. I'm sorry, go right ahead.
And then when they asked students, what would you like to do again, the students with the actual heart had a much higher rate of saying, I want to have this sort of experience again in the science course.
We're talking with the president of the National Association of Biology Teachers, Sherry Onne, Dr. John Pippin of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which is co-sponsoring the bill, which would ban animal dissection in high school classrooms. Keith, in the Fairfax District of L.A., you're on Air Talk.
Hi. My point is that this is a kind of a very pivotal moment in the careers, or future careers, I should say, of, you know, future surgeons and veterinarians, wherein they really get to see quite literally if they have the stomach for that sort of profession, and how could that possibly happen? I mean, in the real world, they're going to be performing, you know, surgeries on real people and real animals, and you can't just use some computer program and then know if you're really going to have quite literally the stomachs to do that work in the future.
Keith, I appreciate your call. Dr. Pippin, your thoughts on that?
Sure. The percentage of middle school and high school students who go on to careers that involve putting their hands in animals is vanishingly small. I will also tell you that of the 209 accredited medical schools in the United States and Canada, exactly zero use animals for any kind of training in their student curriculum. It simply isn't necessary to do that.
Well, don't they use human cadavers for that?
Sure. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You know, unless you're going to be a unless you're going to somehow be an earthworm surgeon or a fetal pig surgeon, it doesn't make any sense. And if you think about it, if U.S. medical schools, even military medical training programs, do not have to use animals to transfer these principles and begin the training process, then why in the world do middle school students and high school students need to do that? And
okay.
I will say in response to Ms. Arne, thank you for your comments, ma'am, that it's equally true that the animal dissections in classrooms turn away as many students from science careers by traumatizing them, and it inhibits them and can be have a negative impact, as well as sorting out who among that group may have, as the caller said, the stomach for this kind of career.
Dr. John Pippin, his organization, he directs academic affairs with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which is a co-sponsor of the bill in the state assembly that would ban animal dissection in public school classrooms. Also, Sherry Onne is president of the National Association of Biology Teachers. Her group is in favor of individual classroom teachers making that call as to whether they want to do animal dissections or not. Just to update you, the fire continues to engulf Notre Dame Cathedral as the sun sets in Paris. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock in Paris. Thousands of Parisians out on the street. The iconic spire collapsed with the fire that burned it entirely and has come down. I'm going to share some of our listeners' thoughts about Notre Dame as the cathedral, this most visited structure in all of Paris, an architectural icon undergoing massive damage in a huge fire. We'll be back in 1 minute. As fire engulfs Notre Dame Cathedral and flames burning across the entirety of the roof, efforts by firefighters to try and save some of the priceless works of art inside. We just frankly don't know at this point what is going to be salvageable. The fire is just absolutely massive. We have Patriot tweeting at Air Talk. I'm so thankful I visited the cathedral 9 years ago with my then 6-year-old daughter. She still remembers it. This is heartbreaking. Gregory in Hollywood says, I'm a timber framer, and I did a timber frame tour of different churches in France about a decade ago. I've been inside Notre Dame several times. Very difficult to get into the higher spots of the church to do anything, let alone fight fires. Well, boy, have we seen that challenge with firefighters appearing not to get any water on this fire for a considerable period of time. Now you've got these heavily extended ladders with water cannons and high-powered hoses where they're trying to get water, but the flame's still burning very bright from the roof. Elle tweets at AirTalk, we took our three-year-old son to Paris last year, visited the cathedral, devastating to see the fire and such an iconic piece of culture and history go down. I'm glad my son got to experience the beauty the cathedral, and he'll have that memory. Again, you can tweet at AirTalk. You can post on the AirTalk Facebook page as well, and to share your thoughts about this massive fire burning at Notre Dame Cathedral. More than 10 million people a year in Paris visit Notre Dame each year. And Eleanor Beardsley, NPR Paris reporter, on the scene. She was on the air live with us in the taxi that she arrived at the scene. We'll hear her reporting on All Things Considered coming up. Right now, we return to our conversation about a bill in Sacramento that would ban animal dissection. Dr. Pippin, I just wanted to ask you, is this would just affect public school classrooms, correct?
Well, I'm reading the bill text, and it says public and private schools.
Oh, okay. So private school ban as well. And what's the thinking for banning it for private schools if they're using their own money to teach the classes?
Well, it's not just about money, although the purpose design alternatives to animals are less expensive. This method of using animals for dissection not only depletes amphibian populations in the wild, but exposes the teachers and students to substances, formaldehyde and its water derivative formalin, that are classified by 10 federal agencies as group 1 carcinogens, that is, quote, known to be human carcinogens. Teachers, students are exposed to this. If parents knew this in California, I think a lot of them would be up in arms about it. And when you consider that these drawbacks are all for the purpose of using a method of teaching that should be on the scrap heap of history in view of more interactive and more comprehensive software-based programs, I think it's a good argument in favor of the bill.
All right, Dr. Pippin of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, Sherry Anne, president of the National Association of Biology Teachers. I certainly remember that chemical smell. It's almost seared into my memory. Your response to Dr. Pippin's claim this is a health risk?
I am not familiar with companies still using formaldehyde. I can tell you that I want to address the piece about students being traumatized. Again, we do support students opting out, as is California's current policy. It's also written in our animal use statement. And then, you know, just this was about 2 weeks ago, a former president of a a high-profile science organization, who's also from Indiana, was visiting my classroom, and just so happened that our anatomy and physiology class was dissecting. We were walking by the classroom, and so we started talking about this California bill. And she's a former biology teacher as well. And what we did, we stood outside that classroom, and you could hear the students actively engaged in that process. And when you ask people, and you mentioned this, do you remember a dissection if you did it? And most people would say, yes, I remember it vividly, and it taught me something about myself. You ask people about a virtual experience, they rarely remember it. And so to hear the high engagement and knowing that if a student wanted to opt out, then that opting out also promotes self-advocacy, as well as conversation between teacher and student.
Let me bring a listener into this. Eddie in Temple City, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, longtime listener.
Thanks, Eddie.
I thought I'd just weigh in on this. To Dr. Pippin about this, to the matter of it not relating, animals not being, you know, used in medical schools, I mean, we can all agree that there's a link between when you first start doing something and you kind of move on, right? You don't start with a dead body. You start at a easy, smaller point for it to be less traumatizing, right?
So you see that the animal is sort of the representation of down the road human anatomy that then the medical school student would engage in. Dr. Pippin, quick response to that, and then I need to wrap.
Okay. Medical schools not only do not use animals for this kind of training, they do not require or even recommend that applicants to medical schools have been exposed to this. And I think the main reason is that anything you encountered in middle school and high school, by the time you get into your professional training, is lost on you. It's not something that is going to give you a leg up compared to anybody else in your subsequent training.
Dr. John Pippin of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which co-sponsors the bill that would ban animal dissections in public and private schools through high school, and Sherry Anne, president of the National Association of Biology Teachers, which wants teachers themselves to be able to make the decision as to whether they use animal dissection or use other methods of teaching anatomy. Have a terrific afternoon from all of us at AirTalk.